Oh my goodness. Goodness gracious, golly me. Happy Monday, everyone. It is Monday, November 2nd, 2020, the year of our Lord. Oh my goodness. My name, of course, is Rich Sabata, your host, and you are listening to the Bodega Body Podcast. This is the health, fitness, and mental wellness podcast for every body. And we are here every single week talking mental health, fitness, and nutrition. And guys, I've got a fantastic episode for you today, as always. But before I get into all that, I first of all want to say thank you to everyone all over the globe listening to the podcast, from Bangladesh to India, Russia, France, Canada, and everywhere in between. Thank you so much for downloading and for listening to the show. It means so much to me. Go follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Rich Sabata. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Bodega Body. And of course, as I've mentioned before, BodegaBody.com is the shopping destination for your fitness and athleisure apparel with a mission and with a cause. 50% of all of our profits are donated to organizations that fight the issues of mental health, fitness, and overall wellness, issues from climate change to social justice and education and everything in between. We've got new designs coming out every single week. We've got new organizations that we're partnering with every single week. So check out bodegabody.com for more information. You know, before I get into the intro for my guest this week, I think it's really hard to not acknowledge the moment that we here in the United States are about to go into. Tomorrow, Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020, is the presidential election. Now, I won't get into who I'm voting for, but because I call myself an advocate for health and food justice, social justice, I think it's really important for me to mention that one of the greatest barriers to health and wellness oftentimes is very tied to political issues and to democracy. And I think I would be remiss to not mention this election. So I know that I've had how to.vote be the sponsor to the show for a couple of weeks now, and you have the resources out there to understand how to vote early if you had had the chance to do that. But if you haven't voted yet, I am urging you, wherever you are in this country, please go out to vote and vote like your life and health depends on it, because this is possibly the most important election in our time that we've been here. And I know tensions are high, and I know things are a bit nuts, and I'm about to talk about mental health and wellness, but this issue to me is the issue of this year that is the greatest barrier, and it is the most important thing that I can tell you today, and that is to go vote. All right, enough about that. This week, I am incredibly excited to talk about mental wellness, and I know this is probably the topic that I talk about the most on a regular basis, and it's probably my favorite topic to talk about, especially because this year, I think we need it the most, and this year, we need a little bit of that, and we need to have these sort of frank, real conversations. And today, I'm talking to Frank King. Frank is known as the mental health comedian. Now, Frank, for his entire life, has dealt with chronic suicidal ideation. And he's a comedian, so Frank has found the way to take his mental illnesses and his mental state, and he has made that his superpower. And he talks to folks from all walks of life on how to take their mental illness and make it their superpower. But he also talks to folks who he considers to be sort of the more normal mental health folks, and he talks to them about how to deal with different mental issues as they come up. And I think you're really going to enjoy my conversation today with Frank, not only because you'll understand on what it means to deal with your mental health and to take something that can be so serious and have kind of a great sense of humor about it, but how you can also actionably do things to better your mental health. And given the state of the world this year, given the state of everything this week, I thought that it would be incredibly helpful and important to listen to this conversation and my conversation today with Frank King. So,
yeah, first of all, Rich, I want to thank you for making your bed. Second,
listen, man, it's been crazy. My life.
I know. You got the new dog. It's 3 months old. It's labor intensive. You get no sleep because you got to get up every 2 hours, take him out to tinkle. I understand.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm not using the video anyways.
been there many times.
Oh, man. Frank, how the heck are you?
I'm doing well. You know, I mean, considering we had a pandemic, we had wildfires, evacuations, but, you know, I mean, it's actually, thanks to the government help, the EIDL, the emergency whatever loan, and the PPP, which they'll probably have some more of that in the next stimulus, and the unemployment for 4 months. And, you know, it hadn't been a horrendous year being self-employed. I've had better, but, you know,
yeah,
couldn't be far worse.
Hey, man, look, I think that we've seen that it can be far worse. So, you know, I think it's good to, I'm not a religious dude, but count your blessings.
Absolutely.
What I mean? Making sure that we can sort of enjoy the misery of life for what it is.
Hey, you know, Oregon, they lost, I think, 600 homes, I think. California's lost 9,000 homes and structures to wildfire. There's a big fire in Colorado. One of my co-authors has a second home.
Yeah.
On the edge of the wildfire. We'll see if she still has a second home, all is said and done.
Oh, yeah. Gosh. Well.
So, but she's safe. Family's safe.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you are wondering who I am speaking to right now.
That's right. The guy enjoying the pandemic. That's what I want.
I wanted to talk today a lot about mental health. And I think the theme of the past couple of podcasts has been a lot about mental health, but I think this is probably the kind of conversation that we all sort of need at this moment, because we're all going a little bit nuts in our own way. But I wanted to introduce this really cool cat that I found online. He is the mental health comedian. Please welcome Frank King.
Yay!
Woo! I should actually do the intro like every week, and I should start piping in crowd noise like the rest of the sports leagues are.
Yes.
So when you listen back to this, you might hear the piped in crowd noise. So look, man, when I saw the mental health comedian, I immediately perked up because I typically hear a lot of different comedy podcasts. And one of the common things that I hear about is sort of depression amongst comedians.
Right.
And so when I saw a mental health comedian, I was like, oh, there's a comedian that wants to actually address his mental health.
Yeah.
So I want to take a step back, man. How did you get into comedy, but how did you get into, you know, being the mental health comedian?
Well, a friend of mine, now deceased, not by suicide, by natural causes, Mike McDonald, a comic out of Canada, used to say there's two kinds of comedians, diagnosed, undiagnosed. We even have a podcast called the Suicide Prevention Punchline, because so many comedians and creative types end their lives by suicide.
Yeah.
Comedy came first. Told my first joke in the fourth grade, and everybody laughed, including my teacher, who laughed hysterically. And I thought, I'm going to be a comedian. And then 12th grade, they had a talent show. Yeah. Nobody had ever done stand-up. I did stand-up. I won.
Okay.
And by my mom was big in education. She goes, look, you can be a stand-up comedian when you get out of college. You can be a goat herder when you leave college, but you're going to be a goat herder with a degree. So I went to school in Chapel Hill, UNC Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And then married my high school sweetheart, high school and college sweetheart. Should have never done that. She was a fine young woman, but we had nothing in common. But you know what they say, opposites attract. She was pregnant. I wasn't. So we moved to San Diego. And just by chance, there was a comedy store there, a branch of the world famous comedy store on Sunset.
Yeah.
I was selling insurance, miserable. Married to the wrong woman, miserable. And not going to open mic nights. And so I have two mental illnesses, major depressive disorder and chronic suicidal ideation. Suicidal ideation for me and my tribe means it's a solution for problems large and small. I mean, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts unbidden: get it fixed, buy a new one. I could just kill myself. So that's chronic suicidal ideation. Yeah. So miserable at work, miserable at home, not doing comedy. And I realized I'm going to kill myself sooner rather than later.
Right.
Then my second thought was, well, what have I got to lose? Divorce my wife, quit my job, try comedy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, I can still kill myself. So that's how I got into comedy. That's why that third TED Talk I did was called Suicide, the Secret of My Success.
Because, you know, it's so funny. I keep thinking to myself as you're talking, I love dark humor and dark comedy in general. But it makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. I love that you are embracing this sort of reality about yourself, and that you have sort of embraced this reality about you. I think when you were thinking about the suicidal ideation sort of piece, did someone tell you, hey, I have chronic, you know, you have chronic suicidal ideation, or is this something that, you know, I don't need anyone to tell me that sort of?
Yeah, self-diagnosed. Because those kind of thoughts have been popping into my head since I was in my mid-20s. When I made the jump to go do stand-up.
Yeah.
Because it was like standing on a cliff, you know, above a 10-story drop into a beautiful lake, and there's a wildfire coming up behind you. Well, if you stay put, you're going to die.
Yeah.
If you jump, you know, you might hit wrong and die, but then again, you might hit just right and swim away. So is it really a choice at that moment? Whereas a neurotypical person who was married, miserable, selling insurance, miserable, thought he should be doing comedy, thinks, well, I could divorce my wife, quit my job, try comedy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, oh, dear God, I would have lost everything. So I didn't have anything to lose. And I've met a goodly number of people that have the very same thought process, entrepreneurs, entertainers, comedians. They're living a life. They feel like they're walking around somebody else's life. They got this great idea, this dream. They feel like they should be doing something else. And so, you know, they're like, they're suicidal. What the hell? I give it a try, still kill myself.
Yeah. I'm curious if you ever actually like consulted with like a professional about some of the stuff that you had gone through at different stages in your life.
Nope. I said, how do you know you're suicidal? Well, let's see. The taste of the barrel of my gun was a big tip off. I had time, place, and method selected. I put the gun in my mouth just see what it was like, you know, and taste of gun oil pretty much tells you you're suicidal at that point.
Now, is it after the gun joke that's good to say trigger warning?
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much. Nicely done.
I'm here every week.
Yeah, that kind of thing happens all the time. I was talking to an event planner for NAMI, Oregon, and I'm doing a keynote. And I go, what do you want me to cover? She goes, now she knows I put a gun in my mouth.
Yeah.
She says, oh, just give us some bullet points. I just let that hang in the air. And she goes, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I can't believe it. I go, relax, Michelle.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. We figured out that it's easy to tell when you want to kill yourself. Yeah. It's pretty easy to tell that, you know, maybe there's something off here. How, how did you figure out how to manage this stuff? Because like, even if you don't necessarily act on it, right? Like, how do you channel that energy into, you know, something that you can live with?
Well, actually, I think it's my superpower because it's a way out. It's a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
If I didn't have my chronic suicidal ideation, I'd probably kill myself a long time ago because I know I can do it anytime I choose. And so by virtue of that, I can stand a great deal of pain knowing that I can make the pain end anytime I want. So it's ironic, but it tends to keep me alive.
Yeah, man. I think, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, as I was talking to you before we had recorded, I have suffered through chronic depression, again, self-diagnosed, and I fall into depressive states all the time, right? I think it's like one of those things where I'm one of those super visionary, ambitious people, and the moment that like something sort of starts to not go my way, or I start to feel stuck, I fall into this like funk. And I start to fall into this like super big funk. And, you know, this first time I'm mentioning this on air, I have had those thoughts before.
Sure.
And I think that for me, my outlet ended up becoming exercise. And I'm usually able to kind of just focus my energy in that. I think when you're talking to folks now, be it in a TED talk, be it, you know, coaching, how are you talking to people about channeling that energy for themselves?
Well, I've been doing a lot of podcasts
to
educate normal people and neuronormal people how to survive the pandemic. Because I realized in March early on that being mentally ill, you know, if you're mentally ill and high functioning, chances are you have a self-care plan.
Yeah.
And some other techniques you use to be able to get out of bed in the morning. Because, you know, when you wake up with mental illness, the world's an uncertain place every day, pandemic or not. Right. And so I realized, I've been teaching, you know, I go, okay, look, normal people, normies, listen up. You need a self-care plan. And here's my plan.
Yeah.
Diet, I'm on the keto diet. I do intermittent fasting. Exercise, I got my, you can see behind me, the listeners can't, but there's an old Nordic track behind me. You don't recognize it because there's no clothes hanging on it. So diet, exercise, good night's sleep, restorative. Yeah. Meditation. That's my self-care plan. Yeah. And I keep a routine. I go to bed same time, get up same time, I eat my meal same time, meditate same time. You know, especially in a pandemic where maybe you're working from home now. So the structure's blown completely out of the water. Your time is your own. You've got to decide when you're going to work and when you're going to binge Netflix.
Yeah.
And so I've had a schedule forever. And then there's something called gamification. I use gamification to get out of bed in the morning. Yeah. I can't get out of the bed. I make a to-do list of six things. And the way I win the game is when I scratch off number six, I don't care if it's 3 in the afternoon, broad daylight, I can go back to bed, pull the covers over my head, and binge watch the second season of Ozark. That's the game. That gets me moving in the morning out of bed. Depression, I used to say that I battle depression, which is incorrect. Because battle implies I can win. And I can't win. I can lose, kill myself, or we can tie, you know, kind of uneasy truce like North and South Korea. That's kind of where we are. So what I say is I live with depression, and rather than fight it when it comes, because it cycles, you know, it's like a flat spot on a wheel, it comes back. I try to blend with the energy. There's a martial art called Aikido, and it's all about blending with your partner's energy. If they throw a punch, you step offline. And you begin to rotate your body the way the punch is going. Yeah. And then at some point you take their balance and then lower them to the ground. So I take an Aikido approach to the depression in that I can harness that energy because it has a great, rather than push back against it, I try to move forward with it until it dissipates. So that's kind of my.
Yeah, you know, I think that's like fucking brilliant. I all the time, like I talk about, overcoming my big depressive state, like the big depressive state, like that's going to be the only one in my life. I'm sure there will be others, but, there's something really great about, I was just talking to someone about boxing and how you got to kind of like flow with energy and you got to feel the energy. Right. And this is sort of in that same sort of realm where you have to lean into it, hear yourself, listen to that moment, and kind of move through it, move with it, instead of pushing up against a brick wall that you know is probably never going to move. That, like, you might be able to climb the wall for a little bit, but there might be some bricks added later on.
Yeah, and Aikido, when you when you step offline and you grab, you know, you get hold of the other person, and you begin to go in a circle, you begin to circle with their energy, you lean into them.
Yeah.
Because what you're waiting for is to feel that you've taken their balance. Hmm. And once you've got it, then you reverse course and you lower them to the ground. We had horses for a time and you need to clean their hooves in the morning. And people say, you know, the horse kicked me, didn't give any indication they're going to kick me. Well, that's not true. When I would clean the horse's hooves, I would again take an Aikido approach. I would lean into the horse so that I can feel where its balance was. Yeah. Because for it to pick up the foot on my side to kick me, it's got to shift its weight to the other side before it does. So as soon as I felt the horse begin to shift its weight away from me, as my martial arts instructor used to say, the whole idea is just not be there when the punch lands. So by the time the hoof comes up and back, I've stepped offline and it just goes through the air. Again, it's a matter of balance and being aware of your position and the horse's, you know, position and balance. So
yeah,
I try to do that with the depression as well. I mean, you know, it's still a struggle.
I know,
it's not pleasant, but it beats trying to, like I said, push up against that brick wall.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, you talked about this a little bit earlier about how we're in this pandemic moment and we've got people who are dealing with the feelings that we have felt in the past and the things that we deal with all the time, right?
Yep.
Like you've got the, as you had lovingly called them, the normies. you've got these folks who were stuck in their apartment with their significant other for 6 months and they realize, oh, holy shit, I don't like my significant other that much. You know, I usually have work.
At the end of the month, can I change families? Is that possible?
No, yeah, exactly. You know, you usually have work to get in the way and you usually have all this stuff. So like, I'm curious, man, like what's the feedback that you're hearing from people now in this sort of pandemic state where they're talking about mental health for the first time, not only from the public perspective, but for themselves?
Yeah, I think the people I worry about, I created a keynote in March called Social Distancing and Staying Sane. Don't worry about your mentally ill friends. The people I worry about are people who are neurotypical or neuronormal who are facing or living with now situational depression. And if you've never been depressed, they may not even recognize, they know they don't feel right.
Right.
But they may not know what the hell. So they go, what do you do? I go, you have a telemedicine appointment with the mental health, clinician of some kind and see if you are suffering from, situational depression. And if medication's indicated, it's not life sentence. Just take the medicine until the pandemic eases up or whatever, and you can taper off when all is said and done. Yeah, I think a whole lot of people will have a whole lot more respect for those of us with depression after this is over. No idea how bad it was.
Yeah, I mean, whenever this thing is over, right? Like, it might be a while. I think that's what's funny. I was talking to my girlfriend's brother about this. My theory around, like, the reason that people aren't telling us as much information and telling us the hard truth that this pandemic is probably going to last like 2 years to 3 years is the fact that they don't think that we can handle the truth.
Yeah.
That like they like the I don't want to cause panic thing. Look, I've said this before on the podcast. I don't agree with the president, but like, the fact that people can't handle the truth, that there's some validity to that.
Yeah, I think my wife and I were talking about the dog walking today, and I think it's probably going to be with us like HIV. It's never going away. There'll be a vaccine or a cocktail.
Yeah.
And the numbers, we won't have 60,000 people testing positive like they did yesterday.
Yeah.
And 1,000 people dying every day.
Yeah.
But I think it will be with us. And as she pointed out, it'll probably mutate, and it probably has mutated.
Right.
Yeah. So it's going to be a long term.
Yeah.
But again, I think it's an eye opener for people who don't normally live with depression and, mental illness and.
Yeah. Yeah. You talked a little bit before about sort of the habits and stuff, and I think that the pandemic has like made the day sort of very monotonous. And I think there's this weird, and maybe a little bit less so in states that have opened up and people are kind of getting the pandemic fatigue, but where you have this like digital fatigue, right? Because like your entire life is the screen. We're doing this over Zoom, yeah. Right? We do our work meetings over Zoom. We do everything else over Zoom. We talk to grandma over Zoom. You know, we want to know what the latest craziest thing the president said, whatever party said. And we spend a lot of time in front of these screens. So like, where do you think people can help sort of look for that balance for themselves so that they're still keeping in touch, but they're not driving themselves nuts with, you know, the piece of plastic or metal that's in front of them?
Well, I think for people who work at home, yeah. You know, they, when you leave the office, if you have a job, as comics say, a job, you know, straight
job. Job.
Yeah, job, a salary job, working for the man. They, you know, when a lot of people come in, they leave the office and the door closes behind them, they can forget the work till they get back the next morning at 8. You know, you can walk out, and then if you're not the boss or it's not your company, then you can, you know, you don't have to think about it all night long. Right. But what's happened now is because this computer screen is here on my desk. So, and I'm sure people leave it on at length. You're essentially always at work.
Yeah.
There is no separation. There's no work-life balance because there's no real dividing line between work and life. It's kind of like kids and bullying. When I was a kid, bullying stopped when you got on the school bus, went home, you left the bully behind. Yeah. Nowadays, kids carry the bully home in their pocket in the form of a smartphone.
Yeah.
So there is no break. You know, there's no relief. I remember Michael Koontz in seventh or eighth grade. I'm going to kick your ass. Leave me on the ball field after school.
Right.
I'll be right there. I got on the bus, went home. He comes up, he goes, where were you? I go, went home. Okay. But yeah, it's. I think there's no break, you know, because the computer, that big, giant, flat screen eye, you know.
Yeah.
It feels very much like, I've been watching Away on Netflix about a trip to Mars with Jennifer Garner.
Okay, yeah.
Which got canceled after the first season. There's another one called Mars. Anyway, then they're always doing this, like you and I are doing. They're always talking, you know, because they're light years away.
Right.
But everything, all the communication is over. It just feels very science fiction at this point.
How do you think people can create, like, the break for themselves?
Turn a computer off.
I mean, you know, it's funny. It's like a duh thing, but like I have to say that like probably some of my favorite nights in the pandemic have been the nights where me and my girlfriend have said, we're not going to be on our phones. We're not even going to turn on the TV. We're just going to like play a fucking board game and cook a meal together and just like turn all that shit off. Like none of it is important. Like all of it can wait till the next day. And I think
A friend of mine.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. You know, a friend of mine has a camp in the mountains for kids who are struggling with whatever. And they take away the smartphones right away when they get there. And they'll give them back to the lady. Yeah. And everybody has to come to dinner. Everybody. Counselors, kids, whatever. And he said that the TV tray back in the day killed family dinner.
Huh.
Because rather than focus on each other across the table, you're staring at the screen with your TV tray in front. And he said the smartphone hit the final nail in the coffin. Because, you know, you see the parents and the kids all around the table, whether they're out to eat or eating at home, they're staring. And so I've got a keynote on digital media addiction. And I recommend parents, they have a power strip in their bedroom. And all the devices have to go into the power strip at a certain hour in the evening. Can't be picked up again until a certain hour in the morning, and you have to turn off the router in the house.
No.
So that nobody has any access, parents especially, you gotta lead by example. Nobody has any access to anything, you know, smartphone, whatever, no digital devices. And I think schools are in this battle. Should the kids have their smartphones with them in class?
Hmm.
And some have said no. Some they banned smartphones from you put it in your locker and you don't get it out until you go home in the afternoon.
Right.
Somebody said to me, well, what if there's like an active shooter? I go, here's the deal. When I went to school, we had morning announcements. We had afternoon announcements. You know, we have loudspeakers in the rooms. What if my parents need me or something, emergency? They'd send some kid who was working in the office.
Right.
Down a little note, hey, call your mom. So yeah, it's not yeah. like we can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think people just like finding the little excuses, you know what I mean? That like they come, yeah. they make up the scenario in their head for the like the what if. And that's like the ultimate excuse for, you know, the not so great behavior that you're reinforcing.
Well, but in their defense, and I was in the backyard cutting brush with a weed eater or something. And my phone popped off my hip, and I spent an hour and a half. And it's not that big a yard. I just could not. It just bounced somewhere. My wife eventually said, "Let's go back out and look again." And of course, when we went out together, it's right there. I mean, I can't believe I missed it. But I realized it's not just the phone. It's not. I mean, I watch Netflix on it. I mean, it's. Right. I have Audible on there when I'm doing something that's mindless that I could listen to a story. It's my alarm. It's got my music on. I mean, it. I realize just how many things that I use that phone for every day. You know, Google Maps and occasionally I make a call.
Right. Occasionally, do you know these things make phone calls?
Yeah, it's somebody said name something that would date you. In other words, if somebody read this about you, they would know how old you were.
Yeah.
And I said, busy signal. I go back farther than that. Party line where everybody in the neighborhood didn't have their own phone. It was a party line and you had a special ring.
Yeah.
And then everybody else picked up and listened in.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's several generations ago, but that's back when phones just hung on the wall. And
yeah. You've mentioned the TEDx thing a couple times. And, you know, talking to the neuronormal and the corporate folks a lot. How did you get into doing that? I really want to do one day. So I'm kind of asking very selfishly.
Sure. Yeah.
So how did you get into it?
The, when I decided that I wanted to speak on suicide prevention.
Yeah.
Because of my family history, because of my history, and I took some training in suicide prevention.
Yeah.
But I'm a comic, so everybody thought of me as a funny guy. Hmm. So I had to rebrand. And my wife goes, "We'll do a TEDx." And I said, "What's a TEDx?" And that week I got an email that said, "Would you like to submit an application to TEDx in Vancouver, BC?" So I sent it in and I got it.
Oh, wow.
It was because I wanted to rebrand as to show everybody that I could be serious. I mean, funny along the way. I mean, there's some really darkly funny stuff in the TEDx.
Yeah.
You know, I looked up suicide on the TED.com site. See how many speeches there were on, you know, suicide. And there were three. And I thought, well, you know, if you're really good at suicide, you're not going to be recording a TEDx. So there was humor in it. But I know. But it allowed me to begin to rebrand with all the meeting planners, event planners, speakers, bureaus.
Yeah.
The thing about TEDx, because I coach it, I've got half a dozen, I think 9 or 10 students right now. We do an hour a week on Zoom and then unlimited phone calls and emails, texts. And what I help them do is find the idea worth spreading. That's the whole premise of the TEDx, is you have an idea worth spreading, you know, worth sharing with people. And generally it's something you're passionate about.
Huh.
That's, I believe, the key to a great TEDx is you are, you know, you eat it, you sleep it, you live it, you breathe it.
Right.
And, you know, somebody said, "How'd you pick suicide?" It picked me, which is ideal. My clients who have something organic that they're passionate about, I got a client with narcolepsy. She has a sleep foundation. She's got a book on narcolepsy, you know, and it's her whole life. And so it's not difficult to do a TEDx pitch, because what happens is they get a couple hundred applications for a TEDx event. And yours has to stand out.
Yeah.
And the way you do that is whatever's in the first couple of paragraphs on that page of the application has to be, you know, interesting, intriguing, got to get their attention, got to grab by the lapels and just hang on. Yeah. The last two I did were Suicide, the Secret of My Success, counterintuitive, Dead Man Talking, play on Dead Man Walking. I got a call from the curation team.
Yeah.
who select. And they go, Frank, we'd like you to, you know, do the TEDx. And I said, you mean the audition? They go, no, you're not auditioning. You're just doing the TEDx.
Awesome.
They like the title, subtitle, and the idea so much. And the next one was Mental Health and the Orgasm, Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly. It took me 16 tries because I knew not everybody was going to like them. But the committee that liked it called me and said, no, you're not auditioning. You're just coming. Pardon me. The, yeah, I know.
That's good.
The,
That's
good. So if you were my coaching client, I would say, yeah. You know, Rich, what do you – passionate about what if I could, if I woke you out of a sound sleep and said give me 15 minutes on blank, you know, that's what I'm looking for, that you could just, you know, right. Like an narcolepsy woman, yeah. If I woke her from a sound sleep and I go, okay, let's talk narcolepsy, I'm sure she could do 45 minutes on breathing hard,
right?
If I could wake her. Sorry, that's really cool.
You know, it's so funny, whenever editing this thing, I'm trying so hard not to like cackle like an old hag because I realize that I have a pretty loud sort of like boisterous laugh and I'm just here like, all right, hold it in, buddy, keep it together. But no, man, look, I think that's great. I think that what's interesting about the TEDx thing, because I get people like asking me about like how to start a podcast all the time, and I'm just, yeah, like, talk about something that you know and that you're good at and that you think that other people would be actually interested in. Like, think about that person. The same principle sort of applies here, right? When you have to focus on the thing, like, and you know, obviously make sure that that thing sort of stands out in a, yeah, crowd of other people who think that they have something to share. Because what I've realized, Frank, in 2020 is that everyone thinks they have a valid opinion to share.
Yeah.
Says the guy with the podcast, right? But but like all of us think that our opinion is the most important opinion in the room.
Yeah, it's I've got a number of different clients, I got a gambling addict, yeah, and he's in recovery, lost $1 million. And I learned a ton about gambling. I had no idea that gambling addicts have the highest rate of suicide of any addiction.
Really?
Yeah, and it's hard to catch a gambling addict until they crash and burn, because there's not a physical, you know, if you're on drugs or you're doing a lot of alcohol, whatever, you know, there's a physical manifestation. But he wants to do a TEDx based on his gambling addiction, and it's a good one because I learned things as we were beginning to work work up his pitch. I didn't know that the rush for a gambling addict is not a win or a loss. It's raising the money, finding the money to make the next bet. That's where the dopamine rush comes in. The bet is almost anticlimactic. I didn't know that. So I said, you know, you need to educate the audience on these things. And you know, gambling is so ingrained in this country. I mean, state sponsored, you know, lotteries and scratch offs, and Washington State's got a sports book. It's, and kids start in elementary school when they March Madness, yeah, they fill out their brackets. That's, and if you listen to the language, our language, let's roll the dice. I'm going to bet on the come. You know, what's the over under? A dark horse. It's been normalized by these things that are in the culture.
Yeah. Even in the political spectrum, man, like, you know, they treat this thing sometimes on the news like it's, you know, like it's all, you know, what are the odds of,
yeah,
you know? So it, yeah, that makes sense.
Well, there's one of those, they're not odds makers, but they are political odds makers. They say, yeah, you know, the Democrats now have a 71% chance of taking over the Senate or whatever it is. So, you know, it's odds. I mean, it's, and I just saw a commercial for this, DraftKings.
Yeah.
It's some kind of fancy. Oh, yeah, and they give away $1 million. You don't have to pay anything to get in. Of course, you know, it's a loss leader. They're going to hook X number of people.
Right.
Who are like my friend and client, who he said, Frank, most people going into a casino with $100 to gamble, it's entertainment. That's, you know, they'll do it and then they'll go home. And
right.
For those people like me, you know, it's just, he went in with $40 when he was 18 years old, and he hadn't left the casino till he lost everything.
Oh, geez.
So yeah, it's, but obviously it's, it's a big part of his life. He would like to help other people.
Yeah.
He's a part of his, at the end of every TEDx, I believe, last third should be what you're going to teach the audience.
Yeah.
And he's going to teach them things like, how do you spot a gambling addict? How do you know you have a gambling problem?
Right.
So that they'll leave with action items or insights on their behavior or somebody else that they know and love.
Yeah. You're making me wonder, especially based off of the couple of examples that you've mentioned, you surround yourself, or people, I'll say, that gravitate to you. And this might be one of those like birds of a feather thing, but like, you know, people that gravitate you seem to be surrounded by like either big tragic things or like deep sadness. And you seem to, and obviously like in your line of work, you talk about deep sadness all of the time. Does that stuff ever weigh on you, man?
No, it's actually therapeutic. Speaking to groups, because almost every time I speak, somebody in the audience, every time but one, somebody in the audience had chronic suicidal ideation. And oftentimes they have no idea it has a name. They think they're just some kind of freak and all alone. College show, a woman comes up afterwards, young woman, about 23, I think. She said, listen, thank you for your keynotes. You're welcome. She goes, but you made me weep. I don't make you weep. She goes, well, you know the story about your car, get it fixed, buy a new one, you kill yourself, you know? She goes, I've been having those thoughts all my life. I thought, I didn't know it had a name. I thought it was just some kind of freak. And she goes, I heard you say that out loud. I realized for the first time in my life that I am not in fact alone, and I wept. So it actually has a reverse effect on me. It doesn't trigger me. It doesn't take me to a darker place. Sharing like that and helping people like that, it's sort of like being George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. When I meet someone like that, I think, you know, I'm being shown what their life would be like if I weren't there to tell them they're not alone.
Yeah.
So my second thought was I can't kill myself now, because if I did, I'd take all those people with me who never had a chance for me to go, hey, you're not alone.
Yeah.
So it's terribly therapeutic for me, and it pays a lot.
Yeah. Have you ever, I'm curious about this really, in like kind of like a dark fucked up way. Like, have you ever had to like talk someone down? You know what I mean? That like someone comes to you and says, you know, like, Frank, I want to kill myself. And I'm like close to doing it. Like, have you ever found yourself in that position where you're like, no, like we got to get you to not do that?
No, I've had a time where I'm going to kill myself. And I said, you know, that'll save me the trouble.
Oh my God.
Yeah. No, I've had people call who are depressed and having a bad day. And I tell people, look, if you're having a bad day, call a crazy person like me. And I give them my phone number. I put it up on the screen every time I speak. But if you're suicidal, for goodness sakes, call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline or text the text line 741-741. Yeah. But no, I've never had to talk anybody off the ledge, you know, off, because I suppose it, someday it will happen. I have talked to friends and relatives, people who are very close to doing it. No. They call up asking, what in the hell am I, what do I do?
Right.
And so depending on the situation, you know, if they're at a distance, but they know the address, call the cops in that town, tell them to go by and do a welfare check.
Right.
But know this, if he's actively suicidal, they're going to take him to court and try to get an IDO and involuntary detention order. And he's going to unfriend you on Facebook, but at least he'll be alive.
Hmm. How do you, for the neuronormal out there, how do you recommend they be better allies, if you will, to the rest of us out here?
Yeah. Well, first off, you know, humans we like to fix things.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a parent, or, you know, you have kids or whatever. But don't try to fix them. There's no fix. People go, will we ever be cured? No, it's not going away.
Right.
How much fish oil I swallow is not going anywhere.
Right.
I tell people when they ask, what do I say to somebody who's depressed? Well, first of all, try just listening.
Yeah.
Just as a friend of mine says, just co-sign my bullshit I'm going through.
Yeah.
Just, you know, just ooh and ah, oh God, oh Lord, oh Christ, I can't believe this. You know, just, don't right. judge. And don't, right. as they say in the mental health business, don't shoot all over them. You should do this and you should do that.
Right.
Because, you know, they can't oftentimes wrap their minds around what it's like to be, you know, depressed to the point where you want to end your life.
Right, right.
They just have, I think I, that the third, fourth TED Talk, I threw in a simile at the end about Sisyphus, the guy, the Greek character who gave fire to man, and they forced him to roll a rock up a hill every day with the idea that someday he could rock over the top, it would roll down the other side, and he would be free. But every time he got near the top, it rolled back down. I said, mental illness is like that. I said, you wake up every morning, there's a rock and a hill. Some days the rock is small, the hill's not so steep. Some days the rock is a boulder, and the hill is Kilimanjaro. But every day, there's a rock and a hill. And sometimes, some days, like it happened to me, you wake up and you can't move the rock. And so part of my keynote is for the people who have mental illness in the room, and part of it's for the neuronormals to try to explain the thought process.
Yeah.
To be more sympathetic and more empathetic.
Right,
Sympathy is easy. Empathy is a little harder.
Yeah. I think that, like, you had said something incredibly brilliant around not drowning people in the should, because I think that, like, one, that's applicable from the mental health perspective, right? And I think that part is obvious. I think that's also really applicable because, you know, we do talk about fitness on this podcast sometimes. You know, it's the people oftentimes think that because they know, like, one thing, that they immediately are the expert in weight loss for everyone. And they say, oh, go do XYZ. That'll be the right thing. So I think it's applicable from both ends that, like, look, you can be empathetic, but don't try to be someone's cure all, because, you know, you're just being a smart ass that no one really likes.
Well, and my dad died young. We had a housekeeper. There's a movie called The Help.
Yeah.
Somebody goes, did you see the movie? I lived it. Thank you. Because that was our era.
Yeah.
And she would say, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one. So if I'm in the gym, you know, and I'm working out, I'm preparing for a contest, and people go, you're how old? You know, and if they ask, how the hell did you get 8% body fat? Then I'll give them a few tips, but I don't volunteer information unless they ask.
So I'm going to ask. Because, you know, I was not expecting, I thought we were just going to talk mental health today, but you showed me a picture of jacked up Frank King about to, you know, like pummel some shit and, you know, jacked up to the gills. So, like, how did you get into the shape that you are in or were in pre-pandemic?
Still pretty much that way. I mean, you know, the exercise equipment at home is not quite as good as it is in the gym or even on the cruise ship. That's one of the nice things about doing cruises is you got long days oftentimes at sea, and you got time to work out, and the buffet is always crowded. The gym never so.
That's fair.
Same 12 hardcore people every day. So I started exercising. Always wanted to be a bodybuilder, do a competition. So January 1st, 18, I was 62, I think. I waited until I was over 60 because I figured everybody else would give up, which they did pretty much. And so I started with the keto diet and then lifting, you know, every day or 5 days a week.
Yeah.
I do 45 on the elliptical because upper and lower.
Yeah.
You know, you get both. And then lifting weights and then stretching. And I have a partner, which helps. And then about August, I discovered intermittent fasting.
Okay.
Bought a book called Eat, Stop, Eat.
Okay.
And it's not a diet, it's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
This morning, when I had breakfast this morning, I had been fasting for 23 hours and 33 minutes.
Yeah.
I usually eat one meal a day, and then I somewhere between 20 and 24 hours, I go without eating. And then, so the keto diet brought the body fat down to low double digits. And then the intermittent fasting got it down. I was 8% when I did my first contest.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Because the reason I did that was I'm never going to be big. I got fine bones. I'm never going to be huge. Right. So I thought, well, you know, at over 60, what they're looking for is vascularity, muscularity, proportion.
Right.
And so I figured if I can just get to where I look ripped, where they're going, holy shit, what do you eat? Spackle and pack and peanuts. Then I could actually, in a natural contest where they polygraph you beforehand and urine test you after. Right. And I'd actually have a shot at winning certainly my category. And my dream is to go pro, win overall.
Yeah.
It's a long shot, but you know, it's a great goal to have.
I think is like really dope about that is the fact that one, you meet so many people, and I'm sure like you might know a couple more people, in this category, but like, you know, people, I think that after a certain age, you shouldn't exert yourself so much, you know, maybe it's fine to let go and whatever. And you were like, fuck it. Like, I'm going to compete and I'm going to, you know, say fuck all that. And I just want to, you know, be ripped as hell. Because it's so funny. Because you showed me the picture. I was like, I want to be ripped like that today. Like, let alone at your age.
Yeah.
It's dope, man.
Selfishly, I mean, you know, vanity. I mean, you know, when I took the picture on a cruise ship. I've been on the ship for like 2 weeks and working out every day really hard, you know, and fasting and they have grilled chicken. It's great because they prepare your meals.
Right.
Anyway, when I got the shot, of course, I posted it in my high school, you know, class of 75.
Yeah.
And, you know, pretty much everybody else I know is retired, you know, and they're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Nice Photoshop. I don't know. Not Photoshop. So yeah, you know, comedians want to be special. That's why we work alone. We want to be doing something like that to me is that something you don't expect from somebody that age. So yeah. And the better you know, the more cut you are and whatever vascular, it's actually part of my self-care plan because it's a way for me to achieve outside of what I do for a living.
Right.
Yeah, I can see the results. You know, you can work toward a goal. So it's a good, I tell people, look, you need to do something outside of your job where you can achieve.
Yeah. You know, that's actually really great. I actually think about that in terms of my fitness as well. Cause I don't ever think I'm going to compete in anything. I've never been good at a particular sport, but like I always strive to perform better in a gym sort of capacity because like I think that it's important outside of like wanting to grow my business and wanting to advance in my career that like I have that other thing that is just for me and it's like really there and that I think is what keeps it therapeutic and fun and interesting and sort of separate from the other stuff that you know I think I can control more the gym stuff versus the work stuff. And the work stuff, there's other dynamics at play there.
Well, and I tell people about the gym, no matter where you are, a 25-pound dumbbell is 25 pounds.
Yeah.
So it's extremely, I mean, the equipment may have different nameplates, but an elliptical runner is basically, so there's consistency there.
Yeah.
You walk in the gym, same smells, same sounds, same equipment. So it's, you know, in a world that's constantly changing, the gym, you know, it's, you may be able to lift more.
Yeah.
But, and I think I told you my workout partner, I did a 4-day fast.
Yeah.
And I was working out at the end of that 4 days.
Yeah.
I was getting ready to eat after I got done. And he goes, man, you are stronger on day 4 than you were on day 1.
Yeah.
He goes, I think they've been feeding you to hold you back. Yeah. That's like food, like you're kryptonite.
I've got to try the intermittent fasting thing, dude. Like that's the one thing that I've heard that it's like, beyond like the paleo diet or whatever, that like it's the one thing that's like closer to what humans like were accustomed to, you know, pre becoming these like, you know, domesticated versions of whatever the hell we are now.
Yeah. And, you know, for example, humans aren't really designed to eat breakfast, but the cereal companies are the most important meal of the day.
Right.
So what I do is I have eight, sometime between 6 a.m. and 12 p.m. And then I just fast until roughly the same time the next day.
Yeah.
The nice thing about it is no pills, no shakes, no, you know, no supplements. You basically just quit eating.
Right.
Saves money. Yeah. And so, and recently I've done a 2-day, 2.5 and 3-day. And, you know, you don't have to buy anything or do anything special or eat any special food or special meals. You just quit eating. And most major religions have a fasting element somewhere for, you know, for clarity and
Right. No, yeah, that's true. That it's like one of the commonalities there. Look, man, for you at this point, what is the thing that beyond your work, like that you look forward to every day and that you look forward to for the future, beyond escaping the pandemic and whatnot, that like, what's the thing that you...
that would be good. Yeah, well, you know, I'm still applying for TED Talks, TEDx yeah. Talks. I'd like to. I got two or three ideas. I got one called depressive realism.
Yeah.
There's some science of people that are depressed see the world more clearly than neurotypicals.
Yeah.
And so that would be one, depressive realism. I want to do one on my adventure coming back from Cambodia on the cruise boat. Mm. Off the cruise boat, where I, you know, that's if you look me up, if you type in Frank King coronavirus cruise boat quarantine, you'll be amazed at the publicity. Worldwide.
I'm gonna have to Google that right after this.
Yeah, so yeah, my talk's gonna be called Going Viral: How the Coronavirus and the Cancel Culture Killed My Comedy Career. Because yeah, it was an international pariah. Oh, before you leave, my superpower, the suicide superpower.
Yeah,
I got death threats when I came back to this county. They thought I came back dragging the virus. One guy calls and goes, "Hey man, you came back to kill everybody in the county." I said, "No, I got a list and you just made the VIP section." Another guy called up and said, "I know where you work out and I'm going to come to kill you." I said, "Okay, that's fine." I said, "I've been trying to do that 40 years, you know, take your best shot." And B, you should know this before you come though. I don't want to die, but I'm not scared of it. So come on. Needless to say, he didn't show. So, yeah. I mean, you want to fight a guy who's got nothing to lose? Come on.
Okay. Oh yeah. My God. Oh my goodness. Oh man. All right. Yeah.
My superpower.
Oh man. That's amazing.
Now that said, Rich, I'm probably the most positive suicidal person you'll ever meet. It's just kind of odd, dude. Friend of mine goes, "Wait, let me get this straight. You work out, you eat in a specific way, very healthily, mm-hmm. very on purpose, and you're suicidal. Why not just have eggs and bacon every day, you know, wait for the heart attack?"
I have to say, and this is probably future content for you at some point, like, I'd love to see, like, a conversation between you and, like, a Buddhist monk or something, you know, just, like, completely throwing this poor guy off. Well, maybe not one of the silent ones, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting sort of dynamic there. Well, Frank, how can the people of the internet find you, work with you, see some of the amazing things that you're doing out there?
Well, 4 to 5 TED Talks are on YouTube. Just type in my name in TEDx Talk. Type in the mental health comedian in your Google machine, and you'll find all my social media, my website. And then I do the yourtedxcoach.com if you're looking to do a TEDx. And I'm, by the way, Rich, I'm creating a course for a company called SpeakerFlow.
Okay.
For $249, 90 minutes on how to get a TED Talk.
No, oh, all right.
Yeah, apparently they work with speakers all the time, and the speakers kept asking, "How do I get a TED Talk?" And they're like, "Google it."
Google.
Yeah. So they said, "Monetize this. We get asked that question all the time." So I said, "All right, we'll put one together." So.
All right. That's
I'll let you know when that goes live.
Yeah, man. Well, Frank, thank you so much for coming for the funnies, for the dark humor, for doing the completely awesome work that you do, man. It's great to see someone take probably some of the darkest things and some of the darkest topics and, you know, being able to do what you do.
I'll leave you with this. I don't know if you ever do this, but I like to screw around with normal people. And every now and then when somebody asks me how I'm doing, I tell them. So I'm really tired one day. I got in this Uber, nice young man. And he looks in the rearview mirror, eyes meet. And he goes, "Hey man, how you doing?" And I said, "I'm depressed and suicidal. How about you?" He goes, "What am I supposed to say to that?" I go, "Do you really want to know?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, you're supposed to ask me if I have a plan." So he goes, "Do you have a plan?" And then there's this pause, and he goes, "Does it involve Uber?"
Oh no, poor Uber. Oh no, poor dude. Just wanted to make his like $2 off of that ride.
Oh my God. Yeah, I got a suicidal guy in a car. What's going to happen next?
Oh my gosh. Oh, poor dude.
All right, man. Well, I got another one here at the top of the hour, so.
All right. Well, you take care, Frank. I know that we will be chatting soon. You are always welcome back to come to the show.
Thank you, sir. Try it. Excuse me. Buy the book Eat, Stop, Eat. I think it'll change your life.
Yeah, I will definitely look out for it. Well, take care, Frank. We'll chat soon.
See you, Red.
Bye.
I'm back in rare form, nigga. I said I'm back in rare form, nigga. Yo, listen. I said I came from the bottom. You an elevator, baby. The struggle made us humble and genuinely crazy. Yo, silver spoon, never. I was raised in the living room. All day smoking haze, praying that I get it soon. I took a nigga pack when I was broke. Almost 20 with no money, up in college lacking hope. Had the whole dorm clicking. You know niggas gotta smoke. Wiping out the competition. Ain't no David had the dope. Couldn't walk in my butters. They only fit G's. Nigga, my wrist freeze. Niggas play Superman and get Chris Reeve. All from a text message. I have your girl on you. You be stretched out before you send your next message. I don't like niggas. Beat around the bush for what? I'm really nice, nigga. Axe around and look them up. I'm in a deli with a bottle trying to see what's goody. Yeti side streets cold. You gon' need your
okay, hoodie. None of y'all niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. Said all my niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. I feel like a precious pebble lodged under the sea. Since I was 8, I knew a 9 to 5 wasn't for me. Shit ain't always how you want it to be. That's why I gotta work hard. My ancestors had to run to be free. At 15, I was running the streets. Drinking liquor, puffing the gweets. Cutting from school, fucking with freaks. By 21, I was sunk in the seat. G-Ride, bumping some beats. Probably looking for something to eat. During my childhood, nothing was sweet. I wore ponies to school. The mother niggas had ups on their feet. It never fazed me though. I knew I was more intelligent. And the gift I had made it even more relevant. When I rap, I touch many like a known therapist. Cause I'm packed with more passion than a gold medalist. I say something, they gon' jack it, nigga. No letterman. I can pop at any time. Shit, there's no telling it. Okay, none of y'all niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. Said all my niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nicely lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride.